I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. In 2014, Emmett Till expert and University of Kansas professor Dave Tell received an offer that seemed impossible to refuse. After researching and publishing on Emmett Till's murder for over a decade, he was invited to make his first trip to the Mississippi Delta. This was the place where, in August 1955, the 14-year-old Emmett Till was torn from his uncle's home, brutally beaten, shot, attached by barbed wire to a cotton gin fan, and sunk in the Tallahatchie River. But Dave Tell's first reaction to the invitation was a firm no. He had no desire to make the trip.
Two reasons. First, I was getting some advice from scholars, from senior scholars in my field whom I trusted and whom I still trust, that, you know what, I had been writing about Emmett Till for 10 years, and if I was going to get my next promotion, I needed to do something different. But more than that, I was working on this model that everything the historian needed was accessible in either archives or books or libraries, that you didn't need to go to the places. You certainly didn't need to pick up a phone or talk to people. And you know what? That was just like, I'm embarrassed to say that, but that's like the world I was living in and writing in. And frankly, it's the world, that world was rewarding me. It was giving me promotions and I was publishing things. And I remember flying down, like my friends prevailed upon me and I did go to Mississippi. And I remember flying down there thinking, you know what, I'm going to know more than everyone else down there just because I've read all the things. And let me tell you how humbled I was when I finally went to Mississippi. The first thing that happened, I found myself in the back seat of a rental car driving across the Mississippi Delta. In the front seat was a historian named Devery Anderson and an FBI agent named Dale Killinger. And Dale was in charge of the FBI case from 04 to 06. And these two were in a conversation about the Till murder that was so far above my head that if I didn't know they were talking about Emmett Till, I would not have even been smart enough to know, to like identify the topic of the conversation. So there was like an intellectual humbling. And then like at the end of this car ride, the car ride ends at Bryant's Grocery and Meat Market in LaFleur County, just outside of Greenwood, Mississippi. If you know your Till history, this is the spot of Bryant's Grocery and Meat Market. It's the site where Emmett Till whistled and the tragedy is set in motion. And there are probably, I don't know, 15 people milling about this site, all of whom are connected with the trip that I'm on. But as fate would have it, I found myself in a one-on-one conversation with Mr. Simeon Wright, Emmett Till's late cousin, who shared a bed with Emmett the night he was kidnapped. And Mr. Wright was telling me these stories of what happened at Bryant's Grocery and Meat Market. And on one hand, like, I knew everything he told me. I knew all the facts. I knew that Emmett went into the store. I knew that he was in the store alone briefly between the moments when his cousins were in there with him. I know that he came out of the store. I know that Carolyn followed him. I know that he whistled, that they ran off. But let me tell you, at least for me, and at least in that moment, it was a different thing entirely to hear Mr. Wright tell that story in the first person, saying, I was standing here, Emmett was over there, we ran this way. And if like the car ride with Dale and Devery was intellectually humbling, the conversation with Mr. Wright, and I don't know quite the right words here, but it was like, I experienced it as like emotionally humbling. Like there is a weight to this story that I never appreciated until I was on site in the place and with the people. My name is Dave Tell. I'm a professor at the University of Kansas and a co-director of the Institute for Digital Research in the Humanities, also at the University of Kansas. I've been writing about the murder of Emmett Till for two decades. I've been working alongside the family of Emmett Till in Chicago for about a decade, working with them to find creative ways to tell the story for the next generation.
I'll be talking with Dave Tell today about his book, Remembering Emmett Till. Dave, welcome to Realms of Memory.
It's great to be here, Rick.
But one thing I'm curious about, so you mentioned, well, you had done 10 years of research and you discover all these stories that you didn't know anything about. There are all these sources that no one had ever used before. Was that because the focus of the scholarship, and you said that there was a lot of scholarship done on Emmett Till, was it just narrowly focused? And you talk about how, one point you say most of the research was from this forensic perspective, a forensic take on Emmett Till. I mean, would you fit yourself into that category up until that time? And does that explain why, how people remembered the story in the decades afterwards? No one paid that much attention to, or no one had really gone down to talk to these people in the Delta?
Okay, I think there's a lot going on here, Rick. First of all, I will say that there is, like, part of what we're dealing with here is a cultural trend that's most pronounced in Mississippi, but is broader than that, of silence when it comes to dealing with harder parts of history. So like I shared a second ago, like, it took 50 years before the state of Mississippi dropped the dollar on Till commemoration. I could give you more anecdotes. Like, for example, it was 30 years before anyone asked the Till family up in Chicago, like, what was this like for you? Like, how have you dealt with this? Like, it was 30 years of silence. It was 1985 when a Chicago journalist first approached the Reverend Parker, who was a Till cousin and is now the last living eyewitness. Like, so there's just like this long silence around it. So I think I'm trying to think off the top of my head when the first book was, and gosh, it took a long time. But then once things get rolling, then we're faced with what I called and what you indexed a second ago as a forensic mode of scholarship. All I mean by that is that for a sizable swath of the Emmett Till scholarship, the main question on the table is who did what to whom, right? It is this, like, I think of it
like
as
a CSI type of thing.
Yes,
you're just piecing together a crime scene.
Exactly. Like, who's at fault? What happened? In what order did events happen? And, like, this is nowhere more evident than the scholarship that focuses on Bryant's Grocery and Meat Market. That's the rural grocery store that Emmett Till and his cousins visited, at which he whistled at the shopkeeper and set the tragedy in motion. Okay. Now, there's just, it's a hard story to tell because there's frankly a lot we don't know about what happened at that grocery store. There wasn't much time when Emmett Till was in there by himself, but there is a little time. And scholars have taken that little bit of time and just, whole books and articles have been devoted to, like, what happened in there. And this is what I mean by a forensic mode. It's like a mode of scholarship that thinks the highest goal in scholarship is to figure out what happened in that moment. And you know what? I'm not against that. Like, I also think it's important to figure out what happened in that moment. And if you spend any time with the Reverend Parker, the last living eyewitness, like, you know that, like, getting to the truth is deeply important to him, and it should be important to all of us. But it's not the only question that can be asked. And when I came to the story, I wanted to ask a different type of question, not because, like, I thought it up out of the blue, but again, because I was on site and, like, the people who were living in the shadow of the murder were not asking that question. They were not asking what happened. They were asking, how do we deal with the murder 10, 20, 30 years on? How do we deal with this murder in the context of an economy that has dropped out, right? And so I began to find myself gravitating to a different set of questions that I don't feel like it sets aside the forensic questions. Like, to do my book, I hope you'd agree, like, there's lots of facts in there and lots of history in there. But what I do feel like it does is it's like, that's the foundation. That's not the end point. Like, I take the conclusions of the forensic scholarship as, like, the baseline. And then I try and say, how do people live with this? Like, what do they do differently because these facts happened this way? And so that's how Remembering Emmett Till begins to take on a unique shape.
So you learn of these stories, you get access to these new sources, and you find this unique way to connect the two. And it sounds like this is related to your background, your interest in architecture, that there's a lot in what you write about that has to do with the built environment, but also the natural environment. So how are these stories shaped by these things, these rivers and buildings and bridges and all, it goes on and on. I mean, how did you arrive at that particular angle or way of connecting the stories, framing the stories?
You know, that's a good question, Rick. And I can certainly say that it was not something I was sitting at a desk and I like thought of. And I don't know quite how to answer it other than to say, like, it caught me by surprise too. The first time anyone visits the Mississippi Delta, I think it's true to say that it is a striking place to be a first-time visitor. And the first thing that will strike you is the natural environment. It is flat and it has, I'm not exaggerating, 40 feet of the best topsoil in the world. And for that reason, both historically and currently, it's an agricultural site. And so when you're there, when you're driving into it, like from any direction, you literally like drop into this lowlands and that is the Mississippi Delta, which is not to be confused with the Mississippi River Delta down by New Orleans. The Mississippi Delta is kind of a football-shaped plot of land in the northwest corner of Mississippi. It's about 200 miles north to south and about 100 miles east to west. The Mississippi River forms the western boundary. And of course, historically, the Mississippi River would flood every single year, right? And sort of deliver to the Mississippi Delta the nutrients from a broad swath of the United States. That's how the Delta became the best place to grow cotton in the world. That's why after the Civil War, it became the heart of the so-called second cotton kingdom. And just to be a visitor driving into the Mississippi Delta, you're like, this place is amazing. Like just ecologically and naturally, it just feels like a world apart. And one of the things you very quickly realize is that it has always been in the, you know what, early 20th century, and now it's a place that's deeply dependent on the natural environment. Like the natural environment weighs heavily and it alters your day-to-day life in ways that for me were not normal. And at the heart of all this is the river, both the Mississippi River on the west side and then closer and more relevant for the Till story is the Tallahatchie River on the east side of the Delta. That, of course, is the river where Emmett Till's body was discarded and discovered. And I began thinking about the river and began really noticing the way that the river organized life in the Delta in ways that I was not used to. And from there, it was a small jump to ask how the river then impacted the way we remember Emmett Till. So let me tell you one quick story about the river. And the most important thing about the river is that it floods. And the most important thing about the floods is that historically speaking, if a river flooded, people didn't have a way in the early 20th century to get from one side of the river to the other. But because flooding was so regular, it was a huge economic disruption if people couldn't get to the county seat. And so Tallahatchie County built two courthouses, one on each side of the river, just as counties along the Mississippi River built levees to keep their economies running. Tallahatchie County built a duplicate courthouse to keep their economy running. Okay. But in 1947, bridge technology comes along. And in 1947, the county finally puts up a bridge. It's on Highway 32. And now no matter what happens to the river, like you can still get across. And so what do you think happens to a poor county with a duplicate courthouse? Well, the courthouse, the duplicate courthouse, which was the courthouse where Emmett Till was the trial happened, begins to fall into disrepair. And even if you like go back and look at the newspaper records at the time of the Till trial, when reporters come in from the north and get there, they pretty consistently comment on sort of the dilapidated conditions of this courthouse. And there's a reason for that. It's because it was courthouse number two in a poor county. And this county, you know, they struggled to keep up one courthouse and they were letting this one slide.
So that built in that the river, you can see really how the river is the backdrop for the creation of that courthouse. When the river is bridged, it's part of the story of how that town of Sumner is its lifeline becomes threatened. Right? So if you talk about, well, there's decades of silence talking about Emmett Till, well, all of a sudden you have an economic incentive, at least on the part of some people, to do something to keep that courthouse alive. That the story of the river that was once the part of the prosperity of the town, now it's contributing to its destitution.
That's exactly right. So if you look like if you go back to 1903, when the year the duplicate courthouse was built in Sumner, like there was a competition between two towns, the town of Sumner, which eventually got the courthouse, and then 10 miles away, the town of Webb. These two towns were competing for the courthouse. Webb, incidentally, is where Mamie Till Mobley was born. Sumner got the courthouse, and because it got the courthouse, it got legal business, right? And so, and it got state business and county business, and it could thrive in ways that Webb couldn't. And if you go there today, you will see Sumner is a relatively, by the Delta standards, thriving town, and Webb is a, you know, it's a series of dilapidated buildings with barred windows because they did not get the courthouse. Okay, so once they put in the bridge and the courthouse begins to fall apart, it's not just a courthouse that's falling apart, it's an entire town that's falling apart. And so, I'm not making this up, in the early 2000s, one of the lawyers who represented the murderers in 1955, he is still a practicing lawyer in Sumner in the early 2000s, and he gets wind that the county is going to close the courthouse because it's fallen apart to such a degree that it's about to be condemned, and it's cheaper just to condemn it than it is to repair it. And they already had a courthouse. And so anyways, they're going to close the courthouse in Sumner. And this lawyer stands up and says, wait a second, if they take away our courthouse, they're going to take away the entire economic, the sort of the only economic engine that keeps Sumner thriving. And if they take it away, Sumner is going to look like Webb in about 10 years. And so this lawyer jumps into action and he realizes that while there is no tax money to repair the courthouse, there may be grant money to restore the courthouse to its 1955 condition. Okay. Do you get what I'm saying? This lawyer made money on Emmett Till twice. In 1955, he made money when he defended the murderers. And in the early 2000s, this is 2004, 2005, he made money when he went out and got grants to restore the courthouse and save his own building. Right. And Emmett Till then was the way, well, like was the mechanism to keep the town of Sumner thriving. And so I share that story because this is a dramatic example of what you said a few minutes ago, how the natural environment of the Delta shaped the memory of the Emmett Till. Like the river flooded and gave us a duplicate courthouse that eventually housed the trial of Emmett Till. But then once the river was no longer a threat, the courthouse began to fall into oblivion until these lawyers acted and really began to reshape the memory of Emmett Till, because this lawyer began working with citizens. And then this is literally the beginning of the Emmett Till Interpretive Center. It's like this great, wonderful nonprofit that I work with weekly that has done amazing things. They've done, honestly, more than any other group in the world to preserve and shelter the memory of Emmett Till.
So this is not, because I guess I had read, I started my podcast with Susan Neiman's book, Learning from the Germans. And she frames all of this in terms of Susan Gleason and the William Winter Institute, and it sounds like it comes across as another outreach program, and they have to pitch this to members of wealthier members of the white community, and they use the economics as a selling point.
I think that's all true. I mean, that's there. Susan Glisson comes in shortly thereafter. But the like chronologically speaking, the first impulse before the William Winter Institute was involved and before Susan was involved, like the literal first impulse was we need to save the courthouse. And then this lawyer begins working with an African-American county supervisor who's profoundly important named Jerome Little. Jerome was the first Black county supervisor in Tallahatchie County. He had to sue the county 7 times because of districting issues to be able to be seated. He won water rights for the Black community in Tallahatchie County. He's an African-American hero to a lot of people. Anyways, the lawyer starts working with Jerome Little, and they start working together, and they have profoundly different motivations. The lawyer wants to save the lawyer cares about Emmett Till because at bottom, that's a way to save the courthouse. Jerome Little cares about the courthouse because at bottom, that's a way to remember Emmett Till. And although they agree on nothing else, they agree that the courthouse needs to be saved and renovated to 1955. And so they're able to work together to do that job.
And what I thought was fascinating is it sounds like they bring in these specialists, architects, to come up with plans and proposals for how to renovate the courthouse, and they provide this script. It's almost like an eye-opening realization that we can use this script to make our case for funding.
Yes, by the script, I think you mean like the sort of...
the claims that you can start to make about the significance of the courthouse, and
yes,
you've got to pitch this to Mississippi funding authorities.
Yes. And so what happens is, I can't remember how many grants they wrote, but I have all of them on my computer. And you begin to see what arguments work for them and what arguments don't. Okay, here's the arguments that don't work. We need to save the legal industry of Sumner. Okay, no one cares about that. But in the early 2000s, if you began to say this is a historically important site in the Black freedom movement, that started to get traction. And so what happened was the claims not only sort of trended towards emphasizing the role in the Black freedom movement, but towards exaggerating, maybe that's a strong word, but we'll go with it, exaggerating the claims of the importance of the courthouse to the Black freedom movement. Claims like this courthouse was... I'm trying to remember. It's been a while since I've looked at this stuff, but it's claimed like this courthouse was where the civil rights movement started, which I don't think anyone would agree with. But that kind of logic really began to open up doors for renovation, and renovation did something remarkable. And here's what it did. We have pretty good oral history evidence that in Tallahatchie County, which is a majority Black county, but also has a sizable white population, that until this nonprofit formed and started working to renovate the courthouse, people did not have conversations about the history of race across racial boundaries. But when they started the work of restoring the courthouse, although the Black people and white people on the committee had avowedly and went on record with different motivations, right? They began for the first time ever to have interracial conversations about the history of race and how that history had impacted the community. For example, Reverend Willie Williams is an African-American mechanic and preacher in the town of Tutwiler in Tallahatchie County. And to this day, he still talks about how in the context of this work was the first time he had ever been invited into the home of some of the white planters that all his friends grew up sharecropping on. And all of a sudden, for the first time, they were in these homes, invited into these homes, and able to sort of work through in a very personal way how the history of the town registered differently for different people.
So you may have had two different groups of people. You mentioned people who really wanted the story of what happened to have a, more of a public airing. Other people who might have had more of the survival of town economic interests in mind. But the end result was that you had communities come together and start talking in ways that they had never done before.
Yep, that's it.
But at the same time, there's certain issues that maybe you can't bridge. And I think you mentioned that's the apology. You know, should the town apologize? How far do you go? How far will people go in signing off on the apology? Do they have to kind of rephrase it? I thought that was interesting how you mentioned that.
Yeah, the nonprofit, which, like as I mentioned, had 18 members stipulated in its bylaws, 9 of them white, 9 of them black. They really, this was the vision of Jerome Little. Jerome Little wanted to offer an apology to the Till family. He wanted the county to be there. He wanted the governor to be there. He wanted President Bush to be there. And he wanted the apology to be unanimous. There were some holdouts. And Susan Glisson, who you mentioned a few minutes ago, was instrumental in sort of eventually massaging the document in such a way that everyone could be on board with it, even if it wasn't quite as strong a document or quite as strong wording as the original draft was. We could go into that story. I think it's more important and it's more interesting to note a couple of things. First of all, the first line of that apology, the first sentence of that apology has since become the mission statement of the nonprofit. It reads like this: we believe that racial reconciliation begins with telling the truth. I hold on to that. I have taken that as a little bit of a personal mission statement as well, in order to sort of emphasize the importance of doing the kind of memory work that this involves. And secondly, I want to note that that apology was the first time the Till family had been back to Mississippi in decades. And so they came to Mississippi for it. At the county line, they were met by a law enforcement who escorted them into Sumner. And there was this dramatic moment where the county offered the apology. The family accepted the apology. There was an unveiling of a monument on the courthouse lawn, or a sign rather, on the courthouse lawn. And then a tour, a bus tour around the county to 7 or 8 different sites where events of the murder had happened that the nonprofit was then committed to memorializing, right? And those sites would be the eventual site of the purple signs they put up. And this takes us full circle back to the beginning of the interview, because that's those signs were the ones that got vandalized, which led to my invitation to go down there in the first place some years later.
And this is the work of the Emmett Till Memorial Commission, right? The creation of these signs.
That's right. And just for purposes of clarity, at the time I wrote the book, it was the Emmett Till Memorial Commission. They have now changed their name. They're the Emmett Till Interpretive Center, but it's the same group of people, and same organization.
Okay. And I thought one of the points that you made was that on the one hand, well, this you can't really understand how the silence gets broken about the Emmett Till past if you don't include the story of the river. It's tied into the history of the town. But at the same time, it's also part of the distortion of that past that the Emmett Till Memorial Commission, the Emmett Till Interpretive Center now. Ends up doing a kind of excessive commemorative work in Tallahatchie County that seems to be way out of proportion to any kind of real historical role it played in the civil rights movement.
So you're correct on all of these points, Rick. And I will tell you that the experience of being in Mississippi, telling these stories, or even just like interacting with both the sites and interacting with the people who are doing the work, and at the same time reading the history, and at the same time like being overwhelmed by just sort of the uniqueness of the natural environment. It led me, like, emotionally, all of this registered as just an overwhelming amount of complexity, that everything is tied together in ways that I never would have imagined going into it. Like, the construction of a courthouse is tied in with theories of where the body was pulled out of the water. It's pulled in with, like, the memory work is tied in with the construction of bridges. And, like, who would have guessed that a bridge, I can't remember what it is, something like 17 miles upstream from where the body was recovered, would eventually launch the largest effort to remember Emmett Till on record. Like, you would never guess this kind of stuff. And so the term that I introduce in the opening of my book to try and account for this complexity, I call it the ecology of memory. And really what I'm trying to say with that term is that until I went there, I had no appreciation for how much everything impacted everything else, like how much racism impacted the way the story was told or not told, how much the poverty of the region shaped views on racial history, and how much even the built environment, which was sort of designed to deal with the natural environment, would end up shaping the way that the Till story was told. And ecology was the only term I could come up with, because in my mind, like, when I heard the word ecology, what I thought of was like the amount that we drive our cars impacts the ozone layer, which impacts the forests in South America. It was like this shorthand term that everything is connected with everything else in super complex ways. And that is what I wanted to communicate, right? Like, once you get into the site, like, if you start messing with the built environment, well, that's going to mess with the natural environment, and that's going to impact the way we tell Till's story. Or if you start from the other direction, if you want to tell the Till story in one way, that's going to have impacts on how you, on courthouse construction and courthouse renovation. And it just was like striking to me how all these things were tied together, and that memory and that, like, our sense of our nation's racial past really could not be separated from questions of either the natural environment or the built environment.
So if the story of Tallahatchie is one of remembering, even if it's excessive remembering, you mentioned that the story of Sunflower County, which were significant events happen in terms of Till's murder, it's a story of forgetting. And you mentioned when you leave out Sunflower County, and it gets left out and intentionally forgotten, you mentioned on multiple occasions, you can't fully understand what happened to Emmett Till. You can't really fully understand the racial implications of injustice. What is the significance of Sunflower County? How does it end up getting forgotten multiple times?
Yeah, so Sunflower County is remarkable. It's the site where Till was murdered. And you would think, because of that, it would get the sort of premier memorial investment. But the opposite is, in fact, true, that Sunflower County, to this day, has zero plaques, zero roadside markers, zero memorials. Okay, in the last 2 years, they now have an annual celebration. A celebration is the wrong word, an annual observance. But the first one of those was in 2022. So, I mean, no matter how you parse it, for 70 years of just nothing. Here's how that happened. The trial was in August of 1955. In September of 1955, there's a freelance journalist named William Bradford Huey who wants to tell the story of the Till murder. And so he rolls into town, I'm not making this up, with a bottle of whiskey, and he rolls, the first place he goes is to the legal offices of the lawyers who defended the murderers. He puts the bottle of whiskey on the table and he says, "I know that these two men who were just acquitted actually killed Emmett Till. I know that you know that too. And so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pay you $4,000. And in exchange, you're going to get the murderers to talk to me. Okay. That's what happens. And this journalist learns some interesting things. He learns essentially all the truth of what happened. He learned that there were not just two people involved in the murder, the two people who had already been tried, but there were at least four white men involved and a couple African Americans involved. But that's not the story he told. And the reason he didn't tell that story is because first of all, he didn't have $4,000. And so he was fundraising and he was a freelancer. And so the first people he pitched was some black newspapers. And I think I'm right here, NAACP, and they turned him down. And so he sent the exact same funding letter to the White Citizens Council, like a white supremacy organization. And he said, if you fund this, I will make this story look good for you, right? So really, I just want to stress that William Bradford Huey only cared about the money, okay? He was not out for it to tell the truth. If the NAACP would have funded him, he would have told a very different story. Eventually, he gets Look Magazine to fund him. And everything's going fine until the editors up in New York City, this guy named Dan Mish was working for Look at the time, says, wait a second, you're going to tell a story in which you accuse two men who have been acquitted in a court of law of murder. And from the perspective of the Look administration, this was a lawsuit waiting to happen. And so the way around it was Look required the journalist William Bradford Huey to get signed consent and release forms from every person he named in the story. Now, it won't surprise anyone that the only people from whom he could get release forms were the two people who had already been tried and were therefore no longer in legal jeopardy. And so, because of these contracts, and I found these contracts lurking in the archives of Ohio State years ago, and because of these contracts, William Bradford Huey had to write the story in a way that only had two murderers. And one of the things this meant is that he had to erase Sunflower County, because when on the night Till was killed, he was kidnapped in Money, Mississippi, in LaFleur County, and he was driven to a barn in Sunflower County. And the reason he was driven to a barn is because J.W. Milam, that's one of the indicted but acquitted murderers, his brother had a barn in the middle of nowhere in Sunflower County. And a barn in the middle of nowhere, of course, was perfect if you want to torture and kill someone. And so they went out to this barn, and that's where it all went down. And William Bradford Huey knew that. And he wrote to his editor early on and said, I know there were four men involved, right? But then he could only get two consent and release forms. And so he had to leave out the Sunflower County brother. And that meant he had to move the murder site. I can't remember. I used to know the precise mileage. It's something like he had to move the murder site, something like 13 miles southeast, and put it on the abandoned bank of the Tallahatchie River. That is a place where there were no witnesses and no one could contradict him. And so the lesson here is that because he could only get two release forms, he had to move the murder site, and he essentially wrote Sunflower County out of the story, okay? And as I show in the book, that pattern repeats itself until the 21st century, until the FBI reopens the case in 04. Sunflower County is written out of the narrative. But here's what I like to stress, or what I continue to stress. If you write Sunflower County out of the narrative, that means you have a very neat, confined, limited murder party of only two people, both of whom were tried in a court of law. Okay. Do you see that geography and race are here like shifting in tandem? Because the moment you introduce Sunflower County, you also introduce the brother-in-law, you introduce a bigger party, some of whom were never even tried for their role in the murder. And so race, memory, and place are shifting all at once. And that's what I call the ecology of memory.
That's interesting. So if you leave Sunflower County out, you really can't understand the full scope and scale of the injustice of what happened.
That's right. Leaving Sunflower County out was a mechanism of sanitizing the murder.
Okay. So I was hoping you could comment on a couple other buildings that you mentioned that are really part of a story of both remembering and forgetting. So you mentioned that, well, you have the original Bryant's grocery store that is sold, it becomes Young's grocery store, continues in operation, and it contributes to, just through its upkeeping, it contributes to this particular forensic way of remembering the past, right? And then when it falls into ruins, it makes it possible to start imagining the past in a different way. So just the way in which the building changes over time, the way it's maintained or falls into ruin, can shape and affect how we can remember the past in different ways. And then you bring in the story of Ben Roy's service station, and you use that as an example of a counter memory. You know, if the market recalls the past, Ben Roy's service station helps to forget it. So, how do those buildings relate to the memory of Till's murder in different, very different ways?
Yeah, these are amazing stories. So just to take your listeners to paint a picture, if you were to go to the place which used to host the town of Money, there's virtually nothing left. In the 50s, there was, you know, about maybe a half mile worth of buildings. There are two buildings left in what was once the town of Money, okay? Or two structures, let us say. One is Bryant's Grocery and Meat Market, which is the site where Till whistled and the great tragedy was set in motion. And one is Bryant, as the other one, and I forget, I used to know the exact number of feet, like 60 feet away is Ben Roy's service station, which it is what it sounds like. It's just a gas station. Those are the only two buildings left. They're both owned by the Tribble family. And the key thing you need to know there is that the patriarch of that family, Ray Tribble, was a juror in the Till trial. After the Till trial in 1955, the Tribble family becomes quite wealthy and buys up really all of the farms around the town of Money and eventually all of Money itself, with the exception of the Baptist church and the post office, I think. And so from the 1980s on, you have the Tribble family owning both Bryant's Grocery, a historic site, and Ben Roy's, a gas station. In 2011, the state of Mississippi puts out a grant opportunity, and it's a grant opportunity designed to recognize the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Riders. And it is like, it targets structures from the civil rights past that need to be restored. Long story short, the Tribbles apply for this grant because they own the town of Money and they own a building that was an important part of the civil rights movement. That is Bryant's Grocery. But, and this is the crazy part, they restore the wrong building. They use the civil rights restoration grant, which gives them, I think, $206,000. And they use that money to restore Ben Roy's service station, which plays no role in the civil rights movement. They justify it by saying, you know, Bryant's Grocery is crumbling. It's falling into ruin. The roof is gone by this point. And Ben Roy's, on the other hand, is still in relatively good shape. And critically, it has like a portico, like a covered front porch from which people can take shelter from the elements, look at the grocery, and learn their civil rights history. And I'm not exaggerating or making this up when I say, with nothing more certain than the claim that people talked about Bryant's Grocery while standing in Ben Roy's service station, the state gave $206,000 to restore the wrong building. Okay. And that has caused generations of confusion. In 2014, the state finally invests in what they call the Mississippi Freedom Trail. It's like the state's official program to officially document and commemorate civil rights sites across the site. And the first place they commemorate, site number one, is Bryant's grocery store. There's a sign out in front that says, this is where the civil rights movement started, and we're off and running. But they put that sign, the first Freedom Trail sign, precisely halfway between Ben Roy's and Bryant's grocery, because they needed to put it on the right of way in a place where they didn't have to ask permission from the Tribble family to commemorate the building, because the Tribble family, as you might imagine, has no interest in, or at least from the outside, it seems as if they have no interest in commemorating a building and telling the story that foregrounds their patriarch's complicity in allowing the murderers to walk free. And so I have been, I don't know, I've probably reached a dozen plus experiences of being on that site or hearing about the site with other people who go there and send me pictures of the wrong building. Because you go there and there's a sign right in between two buildings that says, here's where the civil rights movement started. One of them is restored. One of them is in ruins. And people just assume that the restored one is clearly the civil rights one, but it's not. The Ben Roy's is restored because the family has no interest in commemorating a building that would make their own family look bad. That's the crazy story of how Ben Roy's is renovated and why Bryant's grocery to this day is falling in on itself.
And you mentioned too that Ben Roy's kind of creates this fictional past of harmonious interracial relations, right? That never really existed.
Oh gosh. It's like, if you didn't know the larger story, you'd go in and you're like, Ben Roy's is delightful. It's like pure Americana. It's like old cash registers and glass Coke bottles and milk jugs and mid-modern furniture with like magazines next to the sitting chair. It's like this delightful, I think of it almost as this Leave It to Beaver-ish recreation of what 1950s rural Mississippi would have looked like if racism had not coursed through every aspect of life. It's like this little like panorama into like a perfectly happy American life in which race is not even a factor. And in that regard, I think it's important to note that when Ben Roy's was restored with civil rights money, they put up zero signs. There's nothing in that building that connects it to the civil rights movement or to Emmett Till or to the building just to its north.
And it sounds like the market itself, the ruins, if anything, shine more of a light on problems of racism and neglect. And as long as the market is still standing and resembles its structure at the time of the murder, then people can just fixate on the what happened questions, right? And as soon as it falls into disrepair and ruin, then you can think about how maybe Mississippi as a whole is dealing with issues of racism and justice.
That's right. So I asked, when the University of Chicago Press agreed to publish it, I asked them to make a photo of Bryant's grocery, the cover image of the book, and I had a great one. They, of course, declined. I love their cover, no complaints. But I asked them to make Bryant's grocery the cover because I think the ruins of the building are like, first of all, they're very affectively powerful, but I feel like they dramatize, like in a visual way, the state of Mississippi's approach to the story. They ignore it and they let it crumble. But the more it crumbles, the more people come to see it, right? And the more dramatic it becomes. And it like dramatizes the fact that Mississippi has tried to ignore this story. They have let it fall into ruins. But the more they have done this with both the store and with the story, the more affectively powerful it has become over the years.
So if you're going to do it right, try to tell the Emmett Till story the right way. I don't know, maybe your Emmett Till Memory Project, that's your effort to do that. I mean, how do you work around the all the problems that you pointed out in your book and try to do the story justice?
So one of the problems that you're going to run into trying to do the story justice is the fact that by 2024, there are so many different Emmett Till stories out there, many of which we know to be false, but a lot of which are like, well, maybe that's true. It's hard to know. Here's what I've done, and here's what we do at the Memory Project. We try to tell the story that the Till family wants to tell. And so we have worked very closely with the Reverend Wheeler Parker and his wife, Dr. Marvell Parker, up in Chicago. And we've worked very closely with the nonprofit, the Emmett Till Interpretive Center in Mississippi. And in fact, in 2019, when the current version of the Memory Project went live, I gave them the Memory Project. Like, I still maintain it. I still update it, but you'll notice it's on their website. When you click the donate button, the money, 100% of it goes to them. And so what we're trying to do, at least what I'm trying to do, is to use my skills as a historian and to use my expertise and the knowledge of the Till story to tell the story that resonates most deeply with those who are most impacted by it. And those are the family, the Parkers, and also the folks at the nonprofit. So that's really our goal as we continue to work on the Memory Project.
Dave, thanks so much for taking time to talk to me today. I really appreciate it.
Of course, Rick.
Dave Tell is a professor in the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Kansas and co-director of the Institute for Digital Research in the Humanities. He's the lead investigator of the Emmett Till Memory Project, a GPS-enabled smartphone app that offers a guided tour of sites related to the life of Emmett Till. I've been talking with him about his book, Remembering Emmett Till. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend and review us on your favorite podcast app. I'm Rick Dedarian. See you soon.